Good afternoon and welcome, all of you. This is our monthly meeting of the Midcoast Forum, held today at the resort of Point Lookout between Camden and Belfast. My name is Mac DeFord. I'm the head of the forum, and it was founded in 1983 by a small group of retirees living in the Midcoast of Maine with an interest in foreign policy. Our current membership of about 160 includes former diplomats, international businessmen, retired academics, and others with an interest in foreign policy. For further information, please see our website, www.midcoastforum.org. We have a monthly meeting, almost always on a Monday, to hear an informed speaker discuss a topic of international interest. And today, we are delighted to have with us Adam Hochschul, a Maine native, at least through his wife. Adam, an author and journalist, began his career as a reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle. Subsequently, he worked for 10 years as a magazine editor and writer at Ramparts and Mother Jones, where he was one of the founders. His freelance articles have been published in The New Yorker, Harper's, The New York Times Magazine, and elsewhere. He's the author of 7 books, mostly on subjects to do with human rights, including King Leopold's Ghost, about the, I guess you would say, the rape of the Belgian Congo, as well as Bury the Chains, for which he was a finalist for the National Book Award. He's consulted for the BBC, taught writing workshops for working journalists, not only in the United States, but in England, Zambia, South Africa, and India. His most recent work, which was published in May, and got a leading review in the New York Times Sunday Book Review section, was also reviewed by the New York Review of Books, is To End All Wars, a story of Loyalty and Rebellion, 1914 to 1918. And his topic today is To End All Wars, a New Look at the Conflict That Shaped the 20th Century. Adam. Okay.
Well, thank you, Mac. I'm delighted to be here. I'm just a little bit miffed that evidently there were protesters when the Al Jazeera folks spoke here the other day, and there don't seem to be any protesters today, but maybe we can remedy that. Anyway, it's great to have a chance to tell you a little bit about the subject of my new book, and I hope inspire a new way of looking at the war that was its subject. You know, to write a book about anything, I think, you have to really be obsessed by something. Because if you're going to be working, 6 or 8 hours a day for 4 to 6 years, which is what it usually takes me to write a book, you have to really be fascinated by the subject. And I find that for me, part of the process of writing involves trying to look into myself to find exactly what it is that makes a particular subject so deeply fascinating to me, so that I can try to evoke those elements of it and share it with the people who read the book. Now, for many, many years, the First World War has always been one of those things that has deeply fascinated me. It always seemed to be a presence in our house as I was growing up. My father had been of military age during the First World War, had tried very hard to get into the U.S. Army and was crestfallen that bad eyesight prevented that. Always felt badly about it. Finally actually did manage to pull strings and get into uniform in World War II. I often heard him talk about that. I often heard my mother talk about the First World War because 2 beloved cousins of hers were killed in it. And I think this was something that convinced her that most wars were pointless and shouldn't be fought. And then I had an uncle who fought in the First World War, an uncle by marriage, who was a fighter pilot in the Imperial Russian Air Force. And actually, if any of you have read my first book, Half the Way Home, you will have met him in those pages. And he actually won the highest decoration of Imperial Russia, the Cross of the Order of St. George, which gave you the privilege of having a private audience with the Tsar any time of day or night, a privilege which was not of much use after 1917. But I often heard him talk about this war, and I think that's one of the things that ignited my interest in it. The older I grew and the more I learned about the war of 1914-1918, the more I really realized that it was something worth being obsessed with. The historian Simon Schama once referred to the First World War as the original sin of the 20th century. And I think that's a great characterization because in every conceivable way, it really remade the world for the worse. If you count military and civilian casualties together, it killed something approaching or perhaps exceeding 20 million people. It permanently darkened our view of the world and of human nature, I think, and put an end to that period of rather sunny Victorian optimism. And it laid the groundwork for the rise of Nazism. It ignited the Russian Revolution and all of the death and destruction that followed that. And I think it made almost certain the coming of World War II. It's impossible to imagine the Second World War happening without the First. Now, knowing all of this, looking back on it almost 100 years later, there are, within that aura of significance, there are still aspects of the war which I find, and I think other people have found, particularly fascinating. One is the illusion, the sort of multiple illusions with which it began. And I think all wars start with illusions. And a common one, of course, is that it's going to be over quickly and easily and solve all the problems. You remember that picture of President Bush landing on the aircraft carrier in 2003 with a big sign, mission accomplished. Well, whatever the mission was, I don't think it's been quite accomplished yet. And this was even more true when the First World War started. That illusion manifested itself in many ways. You can find, everybody thought it was going to be over quickly and easily. You can find photographs of German soldiers climbing into railroad cars with "To Paris" labeled on the side. You can find pictures of French soldiers climbing into railway cars labeled "To Berlin" on the side. The German plan for conquering France called for Paris to fall 42 days after the offensive began. It was all very precise. Kaiser Wilhelm II told his troops at the beginning of August, "You will be home before the leaves have fallen from the trees." And of course, it lasted 4.5 years. Another set of illusions, I think, had to do with how the war was going to be fought. Both sides, for example, had enormous numbers of cavalrymen. When the Germans invaded France and Belgium, they did so with 8 cavalry divisions comprising 40,000 horses. And you just have to imagine what kind of insanity could imagine that a great thunderous cavalry charge, however glorious it might look, could succeed in the face of machine gun fire and barbed wire. They just didn't stop to think about that. Another illusion, I think, and this is one of these things that sort of came to me after looking at many photographs and film of the war, is an illusion that I can only describe as the belief that you might be shooting at the enemy, but they would not be shooting at you. How else can one explain the fact that several million French soldiers went to war in 1914, dressed with bright red caps, bright blue tunics, and bright red pantaloons. And they were not the only force in the war that, loved those bright red and blue colors. Austro-Hungarian cavalry, Same thing. And of course, you know, they learned pretty quickly that this just made you a, you know, more visible target for the enemy sniper. Finally, something else I find very haunting about this war is this. We're accustomed in our own time, I think, to expect that wars will take their heaviest toll on the poor. You know, look at those that the United States has been involved with in recent decades, in Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan. Very, very few children of senators, members of Congress, corporate CEOs, or anything like that have been among the casualties of those wars. In the First World War, it was the exact opposite on both sides. The toll was disproportionately heavy among the upper classes because it was officers who traditionally came from the aristocracy and the upper classes on both sides who led their men out of the trenches and into that hail of machine gun fire, and who, just to make it easier for the enemy snipers, had distinctive uniforms that marked them as officers. And the statistics are really quite extraordinary. Just looking at those, for example, from England, 12% of all British soldiers who took part in the war were killed, but for peers or sons of peers, the figure was 19%. Lord Salisbury, who was Prime Minister of England for many years around the turn of the century, had 10 grandsons, one of whom actually is a character in my book. Five of them were killed in the war. Of men who graduated from Oxford, or went down, as the British say, from Oxford in the year 1913, 31% were killed. And among the politicians, the generals, the cabinet ministers who conducted this war, a huge number of them suffered losses in their own family. Prime Minister Herbert Asquith of England lost a son. So did his counterpart, Chancellor Theobald von Bethmann-Hollweg of Germany. General Erich Ludendorff, the most important general on the German side, lost two stepsons. The chief of staff of the British Army on the Western Front, General Sir Herbert Lawrence, lost two sons. His counterpart in the French Army lost three sons. So an extraordinary toll that was taken there. Looking at people like that, I knew that when I tried to write the story of this war, that was one type of character I wanted to explore. The generals, the cabinet ministers, the people who led the fight on both sides, what made them? How could they literally, day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, order their own sons into battle, battles which would eventually have a high likelihood of being fatal? But there was another type of person who interested me very much looking back on this period, and that was the war resistors, people on both sides who felt that this war was absolute madness, who had some sense of the ways in which it was bound to change the world for the worse, and who refused to fight, or who supported those who refused to fight, or who spoke out against the war in ways that got them into deep trouble. In the United States, for example, Emma Goldman and Eugene V. Debs both spoke out very strongly against the war and both went to prison because of it. Debs actually, while still in prison for his opposition to the war in 1920, 2 years after it was over, received nearly a million votes for president on the Socialist Party ticket. Jane Addams, the pioneer social worker, also strong opponent of the war. In France, the socialist leader there, Jean Jaurès, was a strong opponent of the war he saw coming. About a week before it began, he was at an emergency conference of left-wing parties from all over Europe, and before a huge crowd in Brussels, he put his arm around the leader of the Socialist Party from Germany and said, "We will never make war on each other." And because of this, 3 days later, he was assassinated in Paris. In Germany, people like Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht went to jail for their opposition to the war. In Britain, the country's leading investigative journalist, Edmund Dean Morrell, if any of you have read my book, King Leopold's Ghost, you'll remember him from that book, spent 6 months in prison at hard labor for his opposition to the war. Britain's most prominent philosopher, Bertrand Russell, also spent 6 months in prison for his opposition to this war. And as I studied this period, he really came to be one of the people I admired most of all. And I'm going to read you a couple of things that he wrote. I think one of the things that I admired so much about Russell was that he was so honest about the conflict in his own feelings. At the beginning of the war, he wrote about how hard it was to resist being swept away when the whole nation is in a state of violent collective excitement. As much effort was required to avoid sharing this excitement as would have been needed to stand out against the extreme of hunger or sexual passion, and there was the same feeling of going against instinct. A little bit later, he described himself as being tortured by patriotism. I desired the defeat of Germany as ardently as any retired colonel. Love of England is very nearly the strongest emotion I possess, and in appearing to set it aside at such a moment, I was making a very difficult renunciation. But as a lover of truth, the national propaganda of all the belligerent nations sickened me. As a lover of civilization, the return to barbarism appalled me. As a man of thwarted parental feeling, the massacre of the young wrung my heart. 6 months in prison in 1918. I decided that the best way to tell this story was to focus on one country, and that's what I ended up doing, focusing on England, because that was where the conflict that took place within all of the warring countries, between those who believed the war was a noble crusade and those who thought it was something terribly wrong and shouldn't be fought. In England, that conflict was the sharpest. Why? I think mainly because Britain itself had not been attacked at the beginning of the war. France and Belgium were attacked by Germany. You can understand why, you know, French and Belgian soldiers rallied to their country's defense. England was not attacked, and indeed Germany hoped and rather expected it would stay out of the war. Many people in Britain felt, why should we get involved in a war that seems to be other countries' business? I think partly as a result of that, when about a year and a half into the conflict, Britain instituted conscription, more than 20,000 men of military age refused to go into the army. Many of them, as a matter of principle, refused the alternative service that was offered for conscientious objectors, which meant something like driving an ambulance at the front or working in a war factory. And more than 6,000 of them went to prison under very harsh conditions. A bare bones diet, what was called the rule of silence, where you were not allowed to speak to other prisoners. It was extremely cold in prisons because there was a coal shortage due to the war and coal for heating, and of course prisons were the last place to receive any coal that was available. Now, for the longest time, I could not figure out how to get these two very different types of people into the same book, the generals and cabinet ministers on one side and the war resisters on the other. I didn't want to just do a sort of series of portraits of people. And I could not figure out how, in a narrative sense, in an interesting way, I could get them into the same story. And then one day I was reading a very boringly written scholarly article about a well-known British pacifist named Charlotte Despard. Staunch opponent of the war, wrote the best-selling anti-war pamphlet to be published during the conflict, traveled up and down Britain, speaking against the war. Sometimes her speeches were broken up by patriot mobs, sometimes shut down by Scotland Yard. Visited the families of conscientious objectors in prison to try to keep their spirits up. Prior to the war, she had been a staunch radical in all possible causes, big backer of independence for India, had been to jail four times in the battle for women's suffrage, women's right to vote. Anyway, this article was describing these various activities of hers, some of which I'd known about. And then one sentence in passing, the writer said, of course, these activities of Mrs. Despard's were deeply upsetting to her brother. And it gave his name, Sir John French, which I immediately recognized as Commander-in-Chief on the Western Front. And I thought, this is going to be an interesting relationship to explore. And indeed it was, because this brother and sister had diametrically opposite political views, but they were quite fond of each other and continued to see each other throughout the war. They stopped speaking only when, in 1918, the British government sent him to Ireland as viceroy because they felt a military man with a strong hand was needed to suppress the nationalist revolt against British rule that was then breaking out in Ireland. His sister went to Ireland to work for the IRA. They stopped speaking at that point. But that gave me the idea of trying to tell this story through divided families, because the war was felt by many people to be a moral and political issue that divided families in much the same way that the Vietnam War did here in the United States. So I went looking for other families, and I found several of them. And the book is sort of structured around these divided families. Another family, for example, is a quite well-known one whose names you may know in another context, the Pankhursts. They had been at the forefront of the most militant wing of the fight for women's right to vote before the war. Emmeline Pankhurst, the mother of the family, and two of her daughters, Christabel and Sylvia, had been arrested many times and actually had preached an extremely violent form of confrontation with the government. They cut telephone and telegraph wires. They put bombs in mailboxes. they destroyed buildings. They caused millions of dollars worth of damage. And actually, on the eve of the war, Emmeline Pankhurst, the mother, had been arrested for literally throwing a rock through the window of 10 Downing Street, the Prime Minister's residence. The moment the war began, there was a split in this family. Emmeline Pankhurst, the mother, and her elder daughter, Christabel, immediately ceased all their political activity and put themselves at the service of the British government, which was delighted to have these famous troublemakers now working for it. It sent them on speaking tours of Britain and the United States, sent Emmeline to Russia in 1917 to try to rally Russian women behind the war effort. But the other daughter, Sylvia, went very much the other way and ended up publishing the most widely read anti-war newspaper, weekly newspaper in Britain during the war, several numbers of which were suppressed. Her sister Christabel published one of the most rabidly pro-war papers, and the two sisters found themselves attacking each other in their respective newspapers. Sylvia was partly influenced by the fact that she was having a secret love affair with Keir Hardie, really the founder of what today is the Labour Party in Britain, the great trade union leader who was a passionate opponent of the war, who died in 1915, I think, as much of grief over the war as anything else. And that relationship sort of strengthened her and her convictions. And happily, all of their love letters, which are both letters about their love for each other and about the political feelings they had at the time, survive, and those were things that I could draw on in writing this book. It's wonderful when you get a window into people's lives through correspondence like that. There's a third family group also that I focused on. I don't really have the time to tell you all about it, but just suffice it to say that it involved one brother who was in jail as a conscientious objector, actually in solitary confinement for leading a protest against prison rules, three brothers who were in uniform, two of them at the front, and one of those brothers of his was later killed. A further complication was that a very close friend of the family was Minister of War. So those are sort of the core groups of characters through whom I tried to tell this story. But there are some others who come into it also. Friends, rivals, other family members. Some of them are people that I'm sure you know. For example, the writer Rudyard Kipling was a big drumbeater for this war, as he was for every war that Britain ever fought in his lifetime. He very much encouraged a love of all things military in his young son, John. There's a haunting photograph of John Kipling at the age of about four, carrying a rifle that's longer than he is. John Kipling was very frustrated that he couldn't get into the army initially because he inherited his father's bad eyesight. You know, when you see pictures of Rudyard Kipling, he's always wearing those sort of thick glasses with like Coke bottle bottoms. But Rudyard Kipling pulled strings with a field marshal the family knew, finally got John an officer's commission. In 1915, John Kipling went into action at the Battle of Loos and was never seen again. And his father was absolutely devastated, could never get over this. Actually, his father went and got British fighter pilots to drop leaflets in German over the German lines saying, if anybody knows where John Kipling is or where his body lies, you know, let me know. Nothing came of it. His body has never been discovered. Other characters in the book are people you probably don't know about. One of my favorites was a man named John S. Clark. Clark was born in Scotland into a family that was who were professional circus performers. And at the age of 17, he became the youngest lion tamer in Great Britain. Then, by the time the war came, he was deeply involved in politics. He was tipped off at the beginning of the war by a friendly policeman that he was about to be arrested, went underground throughout the war, edited and wrote for an anti-war newspaper that Scotland Yard was never able to find and shut down. After the war, he was able to come back up above ground again, later became a Labour Party Member of Parliament, ended his life spending a decade on the Glasgow City Council much later. And when a circus came to town, he went back into the ring whenever that happened, and was then the oldest lion tamer in Great Britain. You couldn't make up people like this if you tried. But they're real people. Somebody once said that the nice thing about writing nonfiction is that it doesn't have to sound plausible. It just has to be true. And so I can tell you about somebody like Clark and then show you that it's true by showing you a picture of this guy with his arm around a tiger. So where do you get this kind of information when you're doing this sort of writing? The great historian of Victorian England, G.M. Young, once said, read until you can hear people talking. In some cases, people had done some of the reading for me, so to speak, when one or two of these people have had biographies written of them. But it's always much more fun to go to the primary sources. Diaries, very important. And it's lovely that this was an age where almost everybody seemed to be keeping a diary of some sort. Letters, especially love letters, especially when it's a forbidden love of some sort, such as the one I mentioned between Sylvia Pankhurst and Keir Hardie. Keir Hardie was married, he had three children, he was twice her age. It would have been a terrible scandal if this had been revealed. Somehow that makes it even more interesting when you can read the record of a relationship like that in correspondence. Newspapers were very important. These conscientious objectors who were in prison published clandestine newspapers, one of them on toilet paper, and copies of a few of these survive. Other documentary sources I really owe to the British government, especially when it came to the anti-war types, because they watched these people very closely. They were very afraid that this anti-war feeling was going to spread and affect the army. So anytime there was an anti-war group that popped up, they infiltrated people into it. Anytime there was a public meeting of any sort, even small, that was anti-war, there was a Scotland Yard shorthand writer there taking everything down and then transcribing it. They repeatedly raided the offices of anti-war organizations and confiscated correspondence. And all of this stuff is now in the British National Archives. Some of it has been declassified and open to public view only in the last couple of years. Actually, one file that I tried to get was still closed, and I applied to have it opened under the British Freedom of Information Act, and they opened it. So there's sort of an excitement almost 100 years later that you can sometimes have of being the first person to see some of this stuff. So I hope I've made you aware of some of the sources of my obsession and particular interest in this subject, the thing that led me to write this book. And I want to finish by taking a few minutes to read you one short episode from the book. And let me just explain what the background to it was. It was the spring of 1916. Great Britain had just begun conscription. Up until that point in time, they'd been able to get enough army recruits by volunteers. But the carnage was so great on the Western Front in France and Belgium that they had to start conscripting people. But they had not yet worked out a way of dealing with people who refused. And so people who said, I'm a war resister on principle, I'm not going to enter the army, they were nonetheless, at this early stage, forcibly inducted into the army. One group of these men were first held in an old fortress in England, and then they were taken to France. And they were told, we're taking you to the front, and if you disobey orders there, you're in the army now, if you disobey orders now, the penalty for that in a war zone is death. None of their families or supporters knew that this is what was happening to them. They just knew that these men had disappeared into a prison in England. As their train, the train taking them to the English Channel to be transported to France, went through London, they tossed a message out the window, hoping it would be found by somebody and taken to the right people. But they didn't know whether that had happened. So here's the passage of the book that deals with that. Family members and fellow pacifists were horrified when they heard that these men were being transported because the message was found by somebody. When questioned about the men, Lord Derby, the director of military recruiting, declared that if they disobey orders, of course they will be shot, and quite right, too. There was no news of where the men were. Then one day in early June 1916, a clue reached England. An official field service postcard designed to save army censors the time it took to read mail. These cards had half a dozen printed messages that a soldier could either underline or cross out. And this particular one was signed by a 27-year-old schoolteacher named Bert Brocklesby, one of the resistors. All the messages on the card were crossed out, except two. One was, I am being sent down to the base. The other was, I have received no letter from you for a long time. But Brocklesby had lightly crossed out many individual letters so that the message read, I am being sent to Boulogne. Supporters of the men immediately dispatched two clergymen to Boulogne. But would they be in time? While the ministers were still crossing the English Channel, a smuggled letter arrived from France, reaching the mother of a Quaker named Stuart Beavis. "We have been warned today," he said, "that we are now within the war zone, and the military authorities have absolute power, and disobedience may be followed by very severe penalties, very possibly the death penalty. Do not be downhearted if the worst comes to the worst. Many have died cheerfully for a worse cause." To a peace group, he sent a brief message on behalf of himself and his comrades, ending, "We regret nothing." For a time, there was no more news of the men's fate. Now, if I was really being nasty, I would stop here and ask you to buy the book to find out what happened to them, but I'm going to be nice. In the book, I then take some time to tell what else was going on at the front. It was actually the period of preparations right before the huge Allied offensive of the Battle of the Somme, July 1st, 1916. In France, the group of conscientious objectors were taken to an army camp parade ground with other soldiers and given the order, "Right turn, quick march." The other troops did as told. The COs remained in place, unmoving. The army fined them 5 days' wages, something that amused them since they were already refusing to accept any military pay. There was little else to laugh about. Periodically, they were summoned to hear announcements of soldiers sentenced to death for disobedience or desertion. They refused to do any work. Angry sergeants punished them by administering what was known as field punishment number one, which meant being trussed to a fixed object, like a fence or a big wagon wheel, for 2 hours at a time, arms held open in crucifixion position. "We were placed with our faces to the barbed wire of the inner fence," recalled resistor Cornelius Barrett. "I found myself drawn so closely into the fence that when I wished to turn my head, I had to do so very slowly and cautiously to avoid my face being torn by the barbs. To make matters less comfortable, it came on to rain, and the cold wind blew straight across the top of the hill." But the men's spirits held, for when officers weren't looking, ordinary soldiers showed them unexpected kindness. One gave his dinner to Alfred Evans, and when his superiors were gone for the evening, a sergeant of the Irish Guards spent his own money buying cake, fruit, and chocolate for the whole group at the post canteen. Worried that the men's pacifism might influence the troops, the army moved them off base to a fish market on the docks of Boulogne that had been turned into a punishment barracks. There, they were locked in group cells with no sustenance but water and 4 biscuits a day. The men in one cell could talk to those in others only through knotholes in the wooden walls. As best they could, they held debates on Marxism, Tolstoy and pacifism, and the merits of Esperanto. The Quakers among them held a Quaker meeting. For some, the convictions that had put them behind bars were religious, for others political, for many both. They sang both Christian hymns and labor songs. Unable to comprehend so many people acting according to conscience, the military decided that Barrett and 3 other COs were ringleaders responsible for the larger group's mass disobedience. They were court-martialed and found guilty. No one knew whether the messages they had tried to send had reached their families and supporters in England or would have any effect. On June 15, 1916, 2 weeks before the Somme offensive, the 4 ringleaders were taken out of their cells for sentencing. They were brought to a large parade ground, and several hundred soldiers were assembled on 3 sides. The rumble of artillery sounded in the distance. "I cast many a glance in the direction of the white cliffs of Dover," remembered one, "for this might be our last opportunity." A command rang out for silence. "I caught a glimpse of my paper as it was handed to the adjutant, printed at the top in large red letters and doubly underlined with the word death. As each man stepped forward, the adjutant read out his name and serial number of the charge and intoned, "Sentenced to death by being shot." Then there was a pause. "Confirmed by General Sir Douglas Haig." Then a longer pause. "And commuted to 10 years penal servitude." What the men did not know was that their supporters in England had been working feverishly. Bertrand Russell had led a delegation to see Prime Minister Herbert Asquith, and, as he put it, "I made him a speech of denunciation in an almost biblical style, telling him that his name would go down in history with infamy if the men were brought before a firing squad." Asquith then sent a secret order to Haig, the British commander-in-chief in France, saying that no conscientious objectors were to be shot. In the days that followed, while ships, trains, and truck convoys all around them sped last-minute supplies to the front, the men were returned to England and sent to civilian prisons, as would happen with all resistors from now on. In an act of great collective courage that echoes down over the years, they had stuck to their beliefs even when threatened with death. As I stood listening to the sentences of the rest of our party, one CO said later of that day on the parade ground, "The feeling of joy and triumph surged up within me, and I felt proud to have the privilege of testifying to a truth which the world as yet had not grasped, but which it would one day treasure as a most precious inheritance." So I wrote this book partly to try to share the inheritance of such people with you. Thank you.
Thanks, Adam. Very moving. I'll start with the first question.
Oh, you've got questions.
Yeah, I've got questions. Yeah, they were all written. You write that with human losses so great, no one could admit to the error of entering the war or negotiate their way out of it. Only victory could justify what they'd put their populations through. Are we forever doomed to this kind of thinking?
Well, I hope we're not doomed to it. But I think that's in our control. There is one of the things that studying this war made me realize, and I think if you look closely at almost any war, you will see it. There is a tremendous momentum to any kind of conflict like this once it gets started. Why? I think because even when the aim is rather obscure, and sometimes when the aim has been, or purpose has been changed several times, as was the case with our war with Iraq, or when it's not completely clear what that aim is, which I think is the case with Afghanistan today, nonetheless, when you have seen fellow soldiers or members of your family, you know, killed or been horribly wounded, there is a sense that if you question the purpose of the war, you are saying that they died in vain or they were wounded in vain. And I think there's a powerful human impulse not to do that. And that's one of the things that gives such momentum to a war once it gets started. But I do think we have to work hard to stop that momentum anytime a war does come along.
Okay, the next one tries to bring it up to the present time. If in recent wars, Iraq and Afghanistan, there had been a heavy toll on the upper classes of the United States, the educated, upper income, et cetera, do you think our foreign policy would be moving in a different direction? Or to expand this a little bit, suppose we still have the draft, would we still have these wars?
You know, I think it might not be so easy to start a war if we had the draft. You look back at Vietnam, and even though there were various ways of evading the draft, which many people in my generation took advantage of, nonetheless, the fact that sooner or later most men of military age in this country had to make the decision as to whether or not they were going to risk their lives in this war, I think had a lot to do with the rise of resistance to the war. And I think that might be the case in the more recent wars if that were still true. One factor pushing it in the other direction, though, I think, is that there have come to be all kinds of means of waging war, you know, such as pilotless drones and so on, that don't put soldiers' lives at risk. But nonetheless, in some ways, I think the draft would be a good thing, and it might make this country and others a little less reckless about going to war.
Okay, here's a very broad one. What lessons from World War I are relevant today?
I guess I would say the main thing is when the next war comes, which it will, there will be another, I'm sure, don't believe them when they say it's going to be over very quickly. Don't believe them when they say it's not going to have all kinds of unforeseen consequences. Those, to me, are the main lessons.
Okay, and this sort of relates to the last one. We in the U.S. are not immune to what Bertrand Russell called, quote, violent collective excitement. Could that lead us into another blunder like the First World War?
Well, sometimes I do worry about that. And I think my biggest fear is, suppose there is another episode of some sort like the September 11th attacks. There is such a powerful impulse that people have to want to respond, to want to do something. And you saw what happened after September 11th. You know, President Bush at that time used that impulse to manipulate this country into a war with a country which had nothing to do with the attacks. I fear something like that happening again. I think it's a risk.
From your own perspective, going back to Vietnam, does it seem as if we can ever learn anything if, you know, 30 years after Vietnam, we went right into Iraq and then we continue into Afghanistan?
Well, I wish we had learned more than we apparently have.
How about this one? Concept of a just war. Has there ever been one? When was the last one? And this is not necessarily related, but the same person is asking the question. And how do you justify collateral damage?
I think those are very interesting, painful, difficult questions, and I'm not sure that I've got the definitive answer. I don't think I'm a complete pacifist. I think I'm about a 80% pacifist, in that I do think that there are some wars that, you know, even in retrospect, seem worth fighting. The problem is, it's never that simple that the war was worth fighting or wasn't worth fighting. We tend to think, and I tend to think, looking back, that World War II was worth fighting because Hitler and his Japanese allies did want to take over the world. And, you know, we saw what Hitler did to the Jews of Europe. We actually know from captured documents and so on that his intentions were to, you know, wipe out and let starve an even larger number of Russians and Eastern Europeans. We know what the Japanese did in the territories they conquered. This war seems to me, in retrospect, looking back on it, to be, on the whole, a justified one. But we have to remember that it had enormous costs. You know, the total death toll from World War II was something on the order of 50 or 60 million people. It did not prevent the Holocaust, which happened anyway. And it left a huge swath of Eastern Europe under Soviet domination, much to the unhappiness of most people there for about four decades to come. So it's a mixed bag, looking back on it. And I don't think, even though if one has the impulse, as I do, to say, had I been alive then, I would have fought in it, I can't say that, you know, it's a simple matter of good or evil, because I think you have to weigh all of the death and destruction that did happen against the possibly or probably greater death and destruction that would have happened had Hitler and the Japanese not been resisted. But it's tricky. The collateral damage question is even trickier because there's no question that, you know, in wars these days, huge numbers of civilians get killed. This was one of the things, incidentally, one of many ways in which the First World War inaugurated a new era in Europe. This was not a new era as far as colonial wars in Africa or wars of conquest against Native Americans were concerned. Civilian deaths had happened on a huge scale there. But in Europe, it was something relatively new. In the war of 1914-1918, both sides tried very hard to starve the civilian population of the other side. Britain threw a very tight naval blockade around Germany and its allies because they had been, prior to the war, heavily dependent on imported food. And as a result, huge numbers of Germans and even larger numbers of people in Austria-Hungary and the parts of Eastern Europe that the Germans and the Austro-Hungarians had occupied starved to death. Germany tried its best to do the same thing to Britain and France by waging submarine warfare against ships that were carrying food there as well as war supplies from the United States. And this, of course, was what brought the U.S. into the war when they finally started sinking American ships. So inevitably, when you wage wars, there are huge civilian casualties. And very often they are deliberately inflicted, as they were by both the Germans and Japanese and the Allies in World War II, where there were massive bombings of civilian populations in order to try to break the morale of the other side. So, you know, it is very hard, even if you think a war has a correct purpose behind it, it's very, very hard to fight one with clean hands.
Okay, unfortunately, this has to be the last question, and that is, I know your book just came out a couple of months ago, but what are you working on now?
I wish I knew. I have a very hard time finding a subject for a book, because when you put this amount of time into it, it has to be something that deeply fascinates you. And the problem that I have is that 98% of the things that deeply fascinate me do so because somebody has written a very good book about it. So finding my way to a subject in between the books that have already been written, I always find it difficult, and I'm still working on that problem right now. I don't have a clear subject for my next book. I have a couple of areas I'm exploring, but I'm not there yet. Because I not only need a subject that I find deeply absorbing and fascinating, but I need a cast of characters. I think, especially when you're writing about history, if you want people to pay attention, if you want the story to be human and real, you have to find a group of people, a group of people whose lives are connected to each other in some way, through whom to tell the story. So I need both the setting and the cast of characters, and I'm not there yet.
Well, listen, Adam, we know that from what you said earlier that it'll probably be 5 or 6 years before you've thought of the book and written the book, and we look forward to having you back here then with your new book. In the meantime, we'll give you something to remember us by, which is the famous Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations mug.
Thank you.
I think they're all over the world now, and this may be one of the few, actually, for Turner, Maine.
All right.
So, many thanks.
Good. It was a pleasure.